This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Russia, what is to be done? The threat is a tank park at the border of Ukraine in Crimea. The threat is also Belarus weaponizing migrants against the Baltic states. The threat certainly is routine challenge of NATO forces, warships, airplanes, by Russian forces. The threat in these last hours consists of a conversation between the president of Russia, virtually, Mr. Putin, and the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Mr. Xi Jinping, in Beijing. Conversation about how outside interference is unwelcome. And Mr. Xi saying he supports the complaints, the demands of Moscow to have guarantees from NATO going forward. Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, joins me, and we're very pleased to welcome Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Committee. He is the author most recently of, that applies to where we are in this quandary, Implosion, the End of Russia and What It Means for America. Ilan, a very good evening to you. Ever since we talked of your book many years past, I've puzzled if there was a moment where it became clear to you that the Russia of Yeltsin and democracy and markets, that Russia was being retired for what is called the securocracy, the securocrat Moscow that leads with the sharp end of the stick. Is there a moment you can recall before we plow into the present mysteries? Good evening to you, Ilan.
Hey, John. Hi, Malcolm. I think that's a great question. And I think it has to do with Putin's return to the Russian presidency, because as we recall, Putin and his then major domo, Dmitry Medvedev, swapped places, and Putin for a very brief time became prime minister in the late 2000s. And it was when he returned, and it's several years ago now, but when he returned that the tightening came really in earnest. And I think a lot of people are looking, especially at the last couple of years, where the Russian economy is not doing well, the Russian sort of political situation globally is not doing well, where the tightening has really set in earnest. However, I think the architecture was laid a decade ago.
Fine. Then let's go right immediately to the Xi Jinping comment. Before we plow into the details, were you surprised by their exchange of friendship and mutual conduct?
Well, yes and no. I think it's necessary to break out here that, first of all, it's very clear that Russia and China can make enormous tactical gains in terms of partnership in joint opposition to the West, joint opposition to the United States. I think the long-term conversation is a little bit different. Because the long-term trajectory for Russia and China, for China as a rising power, Russia as a declining power, isn't one of cooperation. It's actually one of competition over resources, over territory. But I think all those differences really kick in the medium to long term. For the moment, they're perfectly happy to cooperate.
Malcolm?
Russia has pursued certainly an aggressive foreign policy in its border, along its border, since the 90s with Chechnya, Georgia, Ukraine. Are there lessons to be learned from these conflicts that, and including the strategies for curtailing this aggression, that can be applied to the crisis we're now facing?
No. Listen, I think that's right. And the Russian foreign policy, the adventurism that you see, is part a reflection of Russia's diminishing situation on the world stage. Russia is not going quietly into that good night. Russia is beset by economic problems and demographic problems. And as it declines, it acts more and more aggressively towards its neighbors. But it's also being driven by the perception that there's a vacuum, that Russia has the opportunity now, vis-a-vis Ukraine, vis-a-vis Georgia, in the face of a West that's a little bit conflicted, doesn't really know what to do with regard to Russia, to really set the strategic table. And that's, I think, the proper way to look at what's happening right now with regard to Ukraine. The Russians may move militarily early next year. They may not. But what's already clear is that by making all of these preemptive military preparations, Vladimir Putin has fundamentally changed the conversation about what the U.S. needs to do and what Europe needs to do in order to get him to back down. And that's an enormously powerful tool for him.
But do the Russian people support these initiatives?
Well, it's hard to tell because the polling environment is rigidly controlled and it's overseen. But the indicators are that they do. The most recent polling, which came out just a couple of days ago from the Levada Center in Moscow, says that the majority of the 1,600 odd Russians that were polled about who is responsible for the most recent escalation, only 4% said that Russia was responsible. The majority said that the U.S. and NATO were responsible. And I attribute those results not to the compelling nature of Russian strategy, but rather to how convincing Vladimir Putin has made his domestic propaganda. Over the last decade and a half, he's invested enormous resources in reshaping the narrative about Russia's place in the world. So it's he's recast Russia from being an aggressor to being a victim. He's recast the equation with Ukraine as being the defense of sovereign national interests. And I think that's paying off in spades. I think the Russian people, if they knew the true state of affairs, would be far more circumspect about backing this sort of adventurism. But they're getting a very skewed picture of the world through Russian media.
I'm told the Russian television in Moscow presents this as a story of Russian sympathetic citizens in Donbass and Crimea under attack by NATO and its stooge, Ukraine. Does that sound about right to you, Elon, that Russia presents itself as a victim?
Well, that's precisely right. And I think when we think about, we spend a lot of time doing what used to be known as Kremlinology, to look at, who's up and who's down in the corridors of power in Moscow. We don't spend a lot of time looking at Russian media and the narratives that they feed, that the Kremlin is feeding to Russia's own captive population. As we remember, all politics is local, and Vladimir Putin is doing what he's doing because he has at his back domestic support. If this was an unpopular policy, I think you'd be seeing the Kremlin acting in a much more circumspect fashion.
Malcolm?
Russia's economy is not strong. By any measure, it's the size of Italy, and without oil, the size of Holland. What basis, how would he sustain an elongated conflict or tensions on the border to keep 175,000 troops or 100,000 troops on the border of Ukraine?
Well, I think it's measured against perceived benefits, right? There's only a couple of scenarios here. One is a scenario in which he's serious, in which Ukraine and preventing Ukraine's further westward drift is such an important strategic objective for Russia that he's willing to expend pretty significant blood and treasure in order to keep it from happening. But there's another option that he may be pursuing. Just by carrying out this buildup, by threatening the prospect of conflict, the Russians have changed the narrative, have escalated demands vis-a-vis the United States, have put the onus on the West that they have to give in to Russian demands in order to keep the peace. And that's precisely the message behind the proposals that the Kremlin put forward and sent to the United States yesterday, which talked a lot about the conditions for non-aggression, which include a cessation of NATO, further NATO expansion to the east, a American pledge not to arm states on Russia's periphery like Ukraine, which are menaced by Russian aggression, right? This is Vladimir Putin's pretty long-term strategy of escalating in order to de-escalate.
Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Committee is the author of Implosion, The End of Russia and What It Means for America. Malcolm Hohnlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batley.